we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
All right, well, welcome to another segment on Pulse, America Out Loud. This is Dr. James Lyons-Weiler, and I'm coming to you with news of a new study that came out just recently in the Gazette of Medical Sciences by Perotto, Thorpe, Hooker et al. And this new study asks some pretty tough questions about what's going on in the era of COVID and COVID-19 vaccinations. And to help me out with this are two authors of the study, Tiffany Perotto and Dr. Christian Northrup. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you. Thanks, great to be here.
Great. So start with you, Tiffany. What inspired the study? What was the nature of the study? And what were the questions that you were asking about the effects of COVID-19 vaccinations on women's cycles?
Sure. So a little background on the story. About a year ago, I recognized that there was a really big conversation happening on social media with women who were experiencing dramatic changes in their menstrual cycle. And it kind of set off some red flags because I recognized that there wasn't really any conversation about the effects of the vaccine or even COVID on menstrual cycles and fertility. And so we decided that the conversation needed to happen. So I actually went on a live with Dr. Northrup and a few other doctors, and we realized really quickly that there were not just a few women having these experiences, but tens of thousands of them. And it was really interesting because they were happening to women who were that were postmenopausal, and they were experiencing symptoms that were very rare and very severe. And so we started talking about it, and there were several groups on Facebook and Instagram that were sharing these stories and these women's experiences so that we could try to see if there was anything in common with them. And then censorship came in, and there was actually a Facebook group that had 21,000 testimonials, and it was completely shut down. And all of these accounts on social media that were sharing these stories were completely shut down. And so for me, as a female and experiencing issues myself, I realized that there was a serious problem with not allowing women to be heard in these experiences. So I did a little bit of research, and I recognized that the University of Chicago had a study going about the effects of the COVID vaccine on menstruation. And so I took the survey myself, and I found that it was just a handful of questions, all testimonial based, and it really never got down to the specifics of what exactly these women were experiencing. It was more asking about their mood or if their period was late. And I knew through the testimonials that I had read that there was a lot more conversation that needed to be had about it. And so, you know, with the resources that I had through Millions Against Medical Mandates, we collected some thought leaders and Dr. Northrup, and we put together a HIPAA compliant survey with 91 questions that drilled down into the specifics of what kind of menstrual experiences women were having. And we got very specific into those reactions that they were seeing. And then we also asked questions about whether or not they'd had COVID, whether or not they'd had the COVID vaccine, whether or not they were on birth control, what supplements they were taking, if they were trying to get pregnant, literally their stress levels, anything and everything that could possibly potentially affect their menstruation. And as we spent the next several months collecting responses to that survey and putting our data together, we started to recognize some pretty dramatic phenomenon. And one of them is specifically this experience of decidual cache shedding. And Dr. Northrup can go into a little bit more detail about why that stood out to us. But we have a few more studies that we want to put together with the data from this survey. But the first one that we wanted to make sure we got out there was in relation to this decidual cache shedding because of how rare it and how severe it really is. And so that's kind of where we put this whole thing together.
Okay, great. Well, I've had a pretty good sample size of 6,049. And this study is just a few pages long, this preliminary analysis focusing on decidual cast shedding. So, Dr. Northrup, would you take us through what a decidual cast is and what it means to experience this kind this decidual cast and dysmenorrhea?
It's extraordinarily rare. I've never seen one in my entire career until women began sending in pictures. And what it is that the decidua, so think of this is the layer of shedding. You think about deciduous trees. Those are the ones that shed their leaves in the fall. Well, the decidua of the uterus is what gets shed monthly. But what was happening to these women is after an enormous amount of pain, they would shed what looked like, literally what looked like a plaster cast of the entire inside of their uterus. So not just some menstrual blood, but the entire lining.
So this would have a particular shape. It would look like a triangle almost.
Yes, it looks just like the inside of a uterus, just like the inside of the uterus. And here's what was so interesting to us. Most of the women in our study had not had the shot. They'd only been around people who had had the shot. We also were hearing about little girls, 6 months old, 18 months old, having vaginal bleeding after being around recently inoculated grandparents, women who were having decidual cast shedding when their partners had been inoculated, but they hadn't been. And so we had this idea, and if you look at the Pfizer documents and at a paper from 2015 on shedding of some kind of something with these inoculations, then we realized something was being transmitted, and it is not very well, it's not very well studied. We do know that there's a sequence of the spike protein that matches syncytin. It's an anti-syncytin, and syncytin is the glue, as it were, that holds the placenta together. We didn't get into miscarriages, but the miscarriage rate has been horrific. This was just something so rare, these decidual cast shedding. And Tiffany, what was the final number? I think there was 10 in the world literature. And in our study, we had over 200.
Yeah, 292 or 4.83% of the sample. So that's from zero to 4.83%. So I wanted to pick up on this idea that if you're around someone who has been vaccinated and you're a female, then you might experience some kind of hormonal shift or some kind of an autoimmune shift or something going on. Like you said, the mechanism isn't worked out, but the dysmenorrhea, the amenorrhea, the changes people have, large significant changes in their menstrual cycle. And this one stuck out to you as highly significant, worthy of its own write-up. So when women have this kind of event, if they're in the early stages of pregnancy, what would happen, Dr. Elizabeth?
What would happen if they are in the early stages of pregnancy is that the placenta, the placentation would be interrupted by what would almost be like an autoimmune response. So that the spike protein or something in the spike protein, and this is, by the way, elucidated in Dr. Sherry Tenpenny's 40 Mechanisms of Harm from the inoculation itself. But if the shedding is of the spike protein, then you're going to get that bit of genetic material that directly attacks syncytin, which is the molecule necessary for, actually, it's an ancient viral protein that creates the placenta. It helps fuse cells together. And there's something in the spike protein that attacks that. And that's why we've seen in the women who've had the inoculation, and this is from the New England Journal of Medicine, 80% have a miscarriage if they get the inoculation in the first 20 weeks of pregnancy. And on the first go around of that study, which was June of 2021, they said, oh, there's no problem with pregnancy. Well, apparently they used the wrong dates. I can't remember it because the raw data was so clear in that original study. And then when they went back, they realized they had completely misinterpreted the whole thing.
That makes sense. That's perfectly consistent with enforcing a narrative that you have to stay on the railroad tracks here. So I understand this being a survey, obviously. None of the women involved in this particular study could have donated tissue in search of any evidence of the pathophysiology of the deciduous shedding. But in the future, that should be something that's pretty straightforward and easy to study, right?
Well, I think it would be, in the same way that when someone has a miscarriage, we're very often sending the products of conception to pathology, you know, to look to make sure that they don't have a molar pregnancy or anything of that nature, or if there is a genetic defect, that kind of thing. So I think that we would probably be finding all kinds of things. We know, for instance, that many women who've had the shot and are in the later stages of pregnancy develop what's called IUGR, intrauterine growth retardation. And when you look at the placenta, it looks very, very old. In other words, you're getting blood clotting prematurely. The placenta can no longer support a healthy fetus.
Right. Well, thank you for that. I want to point out that in this Gazette of Medical Sciences, this was a peer-reviewed study as well. And you also had an expert on the author list, an expert in survey design. So this is not, your run-of-the-mill right. study. This was done at an expert level. I think everyone should take a look at this, especially the fact that you basically go from 0 to 3%. Of women having this problem. So I don't know how far you want to go into giving us a teaser about what the rest of the data say. I suppose it should survive peer review first, but I do want to open it up to you, Tiffany. Yeah. Are you finding specifically any evidence of other problems that you suspected you would see?
It's really interesting. And I do want to mention, talking about this mainstream narrative, that's what we're trying to address here, is that something initially, absolutely something is happening and needs to be investigated. That's why we felt this sense of urgency to get this specific study on decidual cast shedding out, so that when doctors do start seeing it in their offices, they can take those pathology tests and take a deeper look into what could have been causing it. And we're beginning to continue to see more and more of those. As I mentioned, the survey is 91 questions long. So we have really in-depth data around the different experiences that people were having. And this is just one of them. And there is serious clotting happening and people missing and skipping periods and people hemorrhaging for months at a time. And so these are not simple, mild symptoms that we're seeing. And as Dr. Northrup mentioned, we also asked the question about proximity. So we all are wondering if it's possible that the spike protein could be shedding from this COVID vaccine and affecting those people around them. And so I can tell you that the majority of the people that completed our survey were experiencing symptoms being in very close proximity to people who were vaccinated, even though they were not vaccinated themselves. One interesting thing I think to mention, as we were talking about miscarriages and conception, which is another piece of the survey, when it comes to this decidual cast shedding, 17% of these women were trying to become pregnant. And so what we're finding is that there is a correlation to a degree with the women who were trying to become pregnant who were not vaccinated, but their spouses were. And I find that very interesting. The other thing I want to mention is I mentioned earlier how we ask all kinds of questions of what could be causing these effects on the menstrual cycles. And so we dive really deep into understanding how stressed out these women are, because in the literature and in throughout history, they say that these issues, and actually in the media today, they say the issues can be caused by things like the stress of the pandemic or the birth control that you're on. And if you look at decidual cache shedding in historical data, it says that, you know, hormonal contraceptives play a role in it. However, the vast majority of the women who are experiencing this are not on hormonal contraceptives. They are not experiencing high levels of stress. They are not falling into the category of the reasons that they're giving in literature as to why this could be happening. And so we're not drawing any conclusions just yet. We're diving deeper into what could potentially be causing this, but we absolutely are not ruling out the COVID vaccine playing a role here and potentially the shedding of the spike protein from those around people.
Well, I think you should continue doing this type of research. Certainly, I think Dr. Northrup would agree that the NIH has been complicit in ignoring women's health issues for decades, and it took an act of God. I'll let you speak on this. We got about a minute left. It took an act of God basically to get them to pay attention to women's issues and cancer. Mm-hmm. And then of course this patriarchal system, when they put out a publication on the on the association between menstrual cycle length and coronavirus disease, COVID-19. This is another study by Allison et al. Obstetrics and Gynecology. All they mentioned was the cycle length. They don't go into anything else. And so Dr. Northrup, could you just, in the last 2 minutes that we have here, really stress for me the importance of making sure that this study continues, that the funding is there, because the NIH won't do this type of study properly.
Well, I remember listening to a Harvard professor, and she said they saw cycle problems, but they weren't life-threatening, and they didn't want to create vaccine hesitancy by studying them. So this is just typical. We now know that the health of the menstrual cycle is a vital sign for women, like blood pressure, like weight, like all of that. So when you've got something that this many women are suffering from, and I've received phone calls from all over the country with this, then something is going on. And the menstrual cycle, don't forget, is the cycle responsible for all life on Earth. So really, it better be studied if you'd like humanity to continue.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. That's a beautiful way to put it. So if you want to hear more about the study, if you want to participate in studies like these, go to mycyclestory.com. And if you want to support this study was funded by millionsagainstmedicalmandates.org. These are my family members over there. These are my people. So go over to mamm.org, hit the donate tab at the top of the page and see if you can support this study. And also go over to mycyclestory.com. Tiffany, Dr. Northrup, thanks for being part of the Pulse.
Thank you so much.
Along with a healthy immune system, clean air is vital for optimal health. According to the EPA, we spend 90% of our time indoors, where germs are most concentrated. It's essential to clean indoor air. Genesis is the only technology that quickly, safely, and effectively kills pathogens both in the air and on surfaces in seconds, reducing the viral load in any environment. The powerful, well-built Genesis Fogger produces a dry, ultra-fine mist using HOCL, which occurs naturally in our own immune systems. We'll be living with airborne diseases in the future. New viruses and antibiotic-resistant superbugs are no problem for Genesis. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next. Visit GenesisFogger.com. America Out Loud listeners receive a 15% discount with promo code OUTLOUD at GenesisFogger.com/OUTLOUD.
People often ask me, Malcolm, how do we fight the corruption? Robert Frost has said it best, freedom lies in being bold. Well, for six incredible years, Bold is America Out Loud. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
You've been in that situation. The person next to you is sniffling, or worse yet, coughing. Flu, cold, and coronaviruses are everywhere. Wouldn't it be great if you had a way to reduce these threats with an invisible mask as an additional layer of protection? Sold by hundreds of pharmacists and medical doctors, our American-made povidone iodine antiviral nasal spray, Cofix RX, lasts for hours deactivating viruses and germs while protecting you from airborne pathogens that make us sick. America Out Loud listeners get 20% off. Use Cofix RX while in large groups, while traveling, or for any other type of high-risk situation as an additional layer of protection to help reduce your likelihood of catching a cold, the flu, or SARS-CoV-2 viruses. Right now, America Out Loud listeners get 20% off of all orders. Click our banner ad on AmericaOutLoud.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
All right, in our next segment, I have the unstoppable, tireless Del Bigtree. We're going to go back to before COVID, and we're going to talk about the kinds of things that were happening, the momentum that was going on in the vaccine risk aware movement, specifically what was going on that we don't want to leave behind with this new distraction of COVID, the main event. So welcome, Del.
James, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Right on. So go back with me, if you would, to 2014, 2015, and exactly what was going on and, you know, what was happening and where were we going and what did we not want to leave behind there?
Sure. Well, I mean, I was working at CBS on the daytime talks for the doctors when I came across the story of Dr. William Thompson, the whistleblower at the CDC. It's, you know, I, of course, made the documentary Vaxxed, which sort of catapulted my career into a different direction than I had planned. Because, you know, pharmaceutical is funding most of television. So once you decide to really come out against pharmaceutical products, you're going to have to make a different career choice. But I would say at that time, you know, that was 2014, 2015. Then 2016 is when Vax released, early April of 2016. And while we were making that film, SB 277, I think that was the real sort of groundbreaking earth shift. And for many, it was a very dark and negative time. But in some ways, I look back at that and think, you know, people say Andy Wakefield's the, you know, the godfather of the anti-vax movement. Well, I mean, running in a close second is Senator Richard Pan. I mean, he woke up a sleeping giant in many ways with SB 277, which, of course, was the law that was going to forcibly inject any child that wanted to go to public or private school. And there was just nothing you could see, no matter how many people showed up for rallies at that time. And we're talking, you know, there'd be hundreds, maybe 1,000, I think on occasion, maybe 2,000 people, some of those big rallies back then. But even when it looked like we were shifting votes, he would manipulate the people in the voting body and shut down the vote and shift people out and move people in and just work the system. So SB 277 passed. And then our biggest fear was, well, if you, you know, take the, you know, the personal belief exemption away from people, your next step will be going after doctors that are writing medical exemptions. No, it won't. You know, sure enough, SB 276, that rams through. And that, of course, goes after doctors that are writing medical exemptions, because what it came down to is the biggest lie ever told, which is this idea that you needed to vaccinate, you know, you needed forced vaccinations or mandated vaccines because there were those that couldn't protect themselves, the immune suppressed. And we had to create community immunity and herd immunity around those children and people who were too sick to take vaccines. But in the end, Senator Richard Pan proved he never believed there was anyone too sick to take a vaccine. Nobody does. They all believe everyone can get a vaccine. You and I have both covered stories of children that are going through chemotherapy and, you know, and you have no white blood cell count to speak of, and still they're being forced to take a flu shot or a COVID shot or, you know, you name it, no one's sick enough to not get a vaccine. And that's what SB 276 proved. He then wanted to investigate any doctor that would write a medical exemption for people that had immune issues. And so there was, you know, there was a great group, I think, called 600 different pediatric offices in California, and said, I have a child that has immunodeficiency issues and I need a vaccine exemption. And I think 600 different pediatric offices said, we don't write any exemptions for any reason. And that was because they were made to be afraid. You're going to be investigated by the government if you do. And so California was really the litmus test for how far things would go. And so you know, it was tough at those times. We were losing that battle in California. But, you know, as Vax started touring the nation, you wrote your book, which was amazing. You and I sort of ran right into each other very early on there in the work that we were doing. And other, you know, so many of us seemed to sort of wake up to this issue of vaccine injury, especially around autism, and the great work of Dr. Paul Thomas, who I know you've worked with up in is he Oregon?
Is he's right? In Oregon.
Oregon, yeah. You know, and one of the greatest vaxxed versus unvaxxed studies ever to be done. And a man who believed in vaccines and recognized that the fewer vaccines he was giving to children, the better off those children were doing in his practice. So all of that, you know, we started marching around. And I think the great addition, of course, vaxxed, I think for many changed the conversation around this, you know, medical tyranny around the world. I mean, it was such an amazing, you know, movement that it exploded out of that. The movement was there, but it really, I think, lit it on fire. And then, so from vaxxed, you know, I created my nonprofit because I had a problem, James. I couldn't answer the question, which was, as we were touring with the film for a whole year and doing Q&As after every screening of vaxxed, you know, we started videotaping Polly Tommy, my co-producer, and we had a bus. We were videotaping all these people telling their stories of vaccine injury after they'd seen the film. They were inspired to tell their own stories. And so though Vax was really about the MMR vaccine and a fraud that took place back in 2000 to 2004, you know, specifically looking at that vaccine, I was hearing stories of every vaccine. After the film would screen, we'd be shooting interviews of people saying my child died after a flu shot or was paralyzed after, you know, the Gardasil vaccine, a star soccer player, and she's never been able to walk since she got her Gardasil vaccine. Or, you know, we never got to the MMR vaccine. Our child regressed into autism after the DTaP vaccine. And so when people would come up to me, they would say, Del, you know, is it only the MMR vaccine? Because that's all that your movie's about. I mean, I definitely want to avoid that one. And all I had was anecdotal stories. I didn't have the science that was behind Vax and the film there. And so I wanted to investigate all vaccines. And that's when I created the Informed Consent Action Network so that I could continue that work and that research. And one of the great additions at that time was I discovered this incredible constitutional attorney named Aaron Seary, who agreed to take on any lawsuit that I thought was necessary. Since, you know, the big shift, James, was I was being told, and I met with so many lawyers, we had to get into courtrooms, we had to fight this in the court. But every lawyer was saying, you can't do anything. Everybody's indemnified. The 1986 Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, you know, took away liability. So no lawyer is going to go near this. There's nothing we can do. And Aaron was the first one that when I talked to him, I said, there's got to be another way around. He said, well, you know, what's interesting is everyone complains about the 1986 Act, but I believe we could use that act to bring lawsuits against the government. Sure, you can't sue the pharmaceutical industry because they have liability protection. But when that protection was given, our government took on the liability and the responsibility. They're the ones that have all the trade secrets. They're the ones that know what's happening, whether it was proper safety studies or tests and things like that. We'll sue the government for that information because they're hiding it too. And I think that that's where, you know, teaming up with Aaron and ICANN, that's where we took things in a direction they'd never gone before. We didn't go through the front door that everyone's expecting, trying to sue where you can't sue or go into vaccine court. We actually sued the government based on the provisions of what was supposed to be happening to make vaccines safer. Remember, the 86 Act was there because they knew vaccines caused an issue. The industry was claiming that it was blackmailing the government, saying, we're going to stop making all vaccines if you don't protect us from liability because we're losing too much money to make this profitable. And so they knew they had a problematic product. And so when they took on that liability, the government took on the liability to say, we're going to fix it. We're going to do the proper research. And so, you know, I'm not going to get into all the details, but we won against a lawsuit against Health and Human Services because they were supposed to be meeting with Congress every 2 years based on the 86 Act.
That was my next area I wanted to go into. So specifically, in terms of the victories that have happened. You've got a concession from HHS saying that, yes, we're not doing these kinds of studies. You've got a concession from HHS that says, yes, we probably shouldn't say vaccines don't cause autism because not every single one of them have been studied for association with autism.
So the first one was HHS. We won, and they admitted that they had not met with Congress ever. They were supposed to be meeting every 2 years to say how they were fixing the vaccine program since 1986. They never had a single meeting. Then we won against the National Institute of Health because HHS was supposed to be deferring to what was like a vaccine safety commission that was going to be headed by the head of NIH, head of CDC, head of FDA, all working together. It was called the Vaccine Task Force. That task force was supposed to be doing proper safety trials and advancing the evolution of vaccines. That task force was never created, and ultimately they disbanded the idea years after the 86 Act, so that was never done. So the two things that were supposed to fix the product never happened. And then we sued the CDC based on, as you said, this claim on the website that vaccines, plural, all vaccines, it's a giant header, do not cause autism. So we asked a simple question. Well, then prove to us, show us the studies that show that, say, the first six vaccines in the first 6 months of life don't cause autism, since you're saying all vaccines have been studied.
Do you remember Do you remember back at Life University, my talk on magic, when we kind of, I think it was the first time we met, I gave a presentation, said, I went through all the literature and I found no studies on all these vaccines, and yet no studies exist. So they must be using magic to determine that vaccines don't cause autism. That's a major concession there. And you also, I want to put a plug out for the work that you guys did in looking at the comparator groups. They're supposed to use inert placebos, saline placebos, and you guys did this massive, massive review. And what did you find in terms of what they were using instead of inert placebos like saline in vaccine studies?
Yeah, well, what we, you know, it really all stemmed from a meeting that was set up by Donald Trump with Robert Kennedy Jr., who was asked as head of Vaccine Safety Commission. That never came fully around, but we did have a meeting. Bobby had a meeting set up by Donald Trump with the NIH. And so we put together a group to come up with what we ended up writing was the Vaccine Safety Project. That was really a series of questions and issues we had with the vaccine program that I've shared in PowerPoints. It's still on our website. Anyone can download it, use it. But it really laid out all the issues I worked with. It was sort of at that time World Mercury Project coming together with the Informed Consent Action Network, several other scientists and doctors and lawyers all to bring the questions to the NIH. But at that meeting, I was sitting across the table from Tony Fauci, across from Robert Kennedy Jr. was Francis Collins. And we asked exactly that. We can't find a double-blind, inert placebo study, the gold standard of randomized control studies to determine safety. We can't find a single one that has been done using a placebo group for any of the childhood vaccines we give our kids. 16 vaccines and 54 shots, 72 doses by the time a child's 18. So our question was, either did you not do those studies and determine safety, as you said, by magic? Or are they just in maybe earlier phase trials that we don't see publicly? And somebody chimed in and said, well, sure, of course we do those studies. We would never have a product that's not safe. We just do them in earlier phase trials. And Robert Kennedy Jr. said, great, that's why we're here at the National Institute of Health. You have all those files here. The public is waiting for them. We'll wait. Go ahead and grab those for us. And there was silence.
Yeah,
I mean, it was like 15. It was a long silence before Tony Fauci chimed in and said, we don't do placebo studies because it would be unethical.
Yeah.
And that was what set us on the course of suing. And of course, we wanted that in court to be admitted. They did. In the end, not a single childhood, and I say childhood vaccine, has ever gone through a placebo study in the licensing phase. Not one of them. Gardasil had a group of 500 out of the thousands that were studied. There was a small group that did have a short placebo group. So that's why I say the childhood CDC schedule. But even that, you can really rip apart whether that was a decent placebo study. But essentially, no vaccine that we give our kids ever went through a proper safety trial. They cannot say they're safe. And I met with a top doctor, I won't name them, from one of the biggest institutions in this country, who met with me when I was traveling with Vax because one of their good friends had an injured child that had autism. And so they agreed to meet with me. And they said, look, I don't agree with anything you're doing, but I watched your film and it's very compelling. But what they said to me is, you know, you keep, I looked you up and you keep making the statement, Del, that vaccines cannot, they've never been proven to be safe. And before I was going to meet with you, I really wanted to take issue with the fact that you're making that statement everywhere you go. And he said to me, I'm surprised to have to tell you that after I looked into it myself, you're right. There is not a single proper safety trial ever done on the childhood vaccines. I'm amazed at that. Yeah. He's like, it doesn't mean they're not safe, but you're right. They can't say they're safe. And that's, well, so, and that's, so that's what that's we fought what convinced at many different
me
levels.
Too, Del. When I went into the science, I couldn't find them either. Remember, I was pro-vaccine before 2015 as well. And
right.
The other thing that really helped me out was to understand, and not many people realize this, but people think that the confessions made by William Thompson were about the MMR. But the thing that really stuck out to me was when William Thompson told Brian Hooker that they have a screening committee that sanitizes all the studies that are done or funded by the CDC. That to me was like it was a punch to the gut. Every single study before it goes to a journal is screened for language that makes vaccines look bad. That's when I knew it was 1984. That's when I knew it was game over. So in the few minutes that we have left here, Del, obviously, my heart's full of gratitude and admiration. Yeah. So I want to get out the URLs of icandecide.org and thehighwire.com. But I want to ask you, how many people have you interviewed for Highwire?
Oh, man. I mean, it's hard to say. We are on, I think, episode 265, something like that. We've done one a week for, you know, the last several years. And I would say I interview at least one person a week on average, if not more. And many, many of them through COVID have been just world-renowned scientists from all around the world. In fact, Highwire started out with, you know, interviews with all the people that had already sort of shifted their focus, the Sherry Tenpenny, Judy Mikovits, you know, people like that. When COVID hit, what was so spectacular about the Highwire is we started being this place where the world-renowned scientists that had just lost their faith in the COVID vaccine needed a place to express themselves because they were terrified of what was happening. And so I had, you know, I, for the last 2 years, have interviewed almost nothing but incredibly pro-vaccine scientists that have shifted their thinking, at least around COVID, all the way down to Robert Malone, inventor of the mRNA vaccine technology, Dr. Peter McCullough. I know we all know these names now, but these were just groundbreaking interviews. And so people would say to me, like, why aren't, you know, these people aren't anti-vax. I was like, no, I know. That's why these are such amazing interviews. You have people that are completely pro-vaccine. They're telling you, do not touch this vaccine. It's not properly safety tested. I know we're running out of time, but for a lot of people, we've been fighting the whole childhood vaccine program. But once we got into COVID, it was clear that they were trying to make the sausage right in front of the public. I knew the moment they said, we're going to make this vaccine warp speed, I thought this is going to be the greatest thing that's ever happened to this movement, because now the world is going to see how a vaccine is made and how little safety testing is done. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened. And, you know, when people were trying to say, well, Del, you know, early on, connect this, show them that the childhood vaccine is just like COVID vaccine. It's like, hold, wait for it. It's sort of like that don't fire till you see the whites of their eyes, you know, statement you hear about George Washington. I said, we need to give them all the rope of COVID that they need to hang themselves. And once they have, then it'll be very easy to make them start thinking about the childhood vaccine program. And here we are. You've got Robert Malone, not only questioned COVID vaccine, I mean, which was originally all he was questioning a year ago. Now he's questioned the whole vaccine program. So is Peter McCullough. So is Pierre Corey. You've got now polls showing in Iowa, the most recent poll, that only 34% of those polled believe that vaccines for children should be mandated at all. That is down from nearly 70% just before COVID. That is a huge shift. I think there was a Politico or one of these magazines just put out that that people aren't getting the measles vaccines for their children. The childhood vaccine program is falling apart. Bill Gates in a video recently said, I'm afraid that maybe the distaste and discomfort with COVID vaccine is going to move over and bring about, you know, hesitancy for the childhood vaccine program. I think they tried to grab the last 5 or 10% of the unvaccinated in America by pushing this COVID. Yep. And in the end, they took their 90% you know, vaccine confidence rate in America. And I believe they've dropped that below 50%. We have absolutely won this battle. And we're now well on our way to winning the war, because less because of what the work that we did, and more because of the mistakes they made by showing the world how totally sinister and pathetic and poorly made these products are.
Well, what your organization and my organization, IPAC and IPAC ADU, have done, and Robert E. Kennedy's organization, Children's Health, is we've provided instruments of interpretation. So yeah. As those events came, they walked right into it. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to hear more from Del Bigtree and you want to hear more from me, come to the Next Steps Conference and UI Media Awards, June 3rd and 4th. Go to next-steps.info in Atlanta. Tia Severino and company are throwing this massive Next Steps. I wish I had time to ask you about Next Steps, Del, but we're out of time. Thanks so much for being part of Pulse.
Thank you.
I want to put in a big word for healthy cell supplements. The GI tract is not functioning normally in long COVID syndrome. I'm convinced of it. There are multiple studies. We need a much better absorbed set of nutraceutical and vitamin products for long COVID syndrome, and that's Healthy Cell. They have an entire line that's safe and effective, can help people through the long COVID syndrome. I found the best way to use Healthy Cell products is use them every day, not on and off, on and off. Take them every day consistently. The Immune Super Boost, Focus and Memory, and the REM Sleep Supplement all have powerful effects in long COVID syndrome. Go to HealthyCell.com and in the promo code, type in out loud for 20% off your first order. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Because of COVID-19, many Americans worry about their health 4 times a day. That's 120 times per month. To minimize the worries, leading nutritional supplement company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost, an immune supplement that contains full effective doses of science-backed nutrients like vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in a one-a-day, pill-free, ultra-absorption ingestible gel. It tastes great, comes in a convenient squeeze gel pack, and it's more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Supporting a strong and resilient immune system can be simple. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of Immune Super Boost. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
All right, for our next segment, we have some initiatives in Pennsylvania specifically addressing the question of medical freedom, which we talk about extensively here, job loss threat over medical options, and off-label use. And so I am so honored and thrilled to have a professional and my friend, Dr. Stephanie Coxon, a Pennsylvania Coalition for Informed Consent, to talk about these initiatives. Stephanie, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Right on. So I want the people to understand that what you're actually doing is promoting bills. It's the people standing up that so that the rights that are already enshrined in the U.S. Constitution are doubly enshrined in the laws of the land in Pennsylvania. So why don't we start with the medical freedom issue? What is wrong with the situation in Pennsylvania where people don't have medical freedom? Can you describe that, and then describe your initiative and what people could do to help?
Yeah, well, currently we're looking at a lot of people losing their jobs or livelihoods because of not wanting to get the vaccine. And one of the things that really hit home with me is a good friend of mine watched her mom die from the vaccine and then had to go and get it in order to keep her job. So a single mother of two was put in a situation where she was either going to lose her job, her capability to live, or go get the jab that she watched her mother die from. And so it's just heartbreaking, some of the stories that we are getting in. And because of that, and we're seeing this across the state, this isn't just my friend. We are getting tons and tons of stories similar to this coming in. And so what PCIC does is we really watch legislation and then help to get legislation noticed with sponsors and stuff like that, so that people will be able to have these freedoms and be able to say no. And so we have a few bills that are out. We have actually quite a few really good bills that are out right now receiving attention that I just thought would be great to highlight so that other people can realize there are people fighting for them. There's senators and legislators just fighting for the people of Pennsylvania.
Okay, so let's get down to the weeds. What's the first one that you wanted to talk about here?
So one of the big ones is House Bill 2013. And why it's so big, probably the average bill has about 10 co-sponsors. This bill is up to 44 co-sponsors right now. And this is going to add a new Section 30 to Pennsylvania's Declaration of Rights. And this is a right to medical freedom across the board. So this is huge. So it's the right of an individual to refuse any medical procedure, treatment, injection, vaccine, prophylactic therapy. And it can't be questioned or interfered with in any manner. So this goes into the amendment. And what's different about this is it actually has to go through the two consecutive sessions, and then it gets voted on by the people. And so if we can get this through the House in December, and then we have to do it again in the next session, which would be January, it goes up for a vote in May of 2023 in the primary. And this would allow the people of Pennsylvania to vote and say, do they want the right to say no to a medical procedure if they walk into a hospital or into a doctor's office and not have a repercussion? It allows you to say no if you're going to an employer and they tell you you have to do something, and it allows the people to say no. And this one is a constitutional change. And so our constitution holds more bearing if it's not outlined in the federal constitution. So this is huge. And you have a lot of legislators that are on board with this. So this one is probably one of the primary ones that we really want to get attention for, because we need this to pass. But we also have a couple other ones that are really important. One is House Bill 1741. Don Kiefer put out this bill. It's basically the off-label use of medications to treat coronavirus infections. And as you know, off-label use is pretty common for any situation, any doctor. And yet in this particular virus, they are trying to prevent that. And they are going after doctors who are using off-label medications for this particular virus. So this is a protection both for the doctors and for the pharmacies who want to do that. And that one really just needs more legislative commitment for that bill, legislator commitment for that bill to go through. And then the last one that I think is really important. So there are some Senate bills. So Mastriano has been like a champion for the freedom movement since all of this kind of started. And he's put out several bills. But one of the bills that's just kind of been sitting there, so it's been sitting on the floor, it's House Bill 471. And this one is basically, you know, protections from the coronavirus vaccine, making it mandatory through employment. And if something were to happen, employees would still have to pay you your unemployment. You can't be denied anything. You cannot be denied rights because you did not get the vaccine. So this one is essentially out there, but Pennsylvania leadership, like Jay Corman, is not pushing it. And so we really need the leadership to get this out there and get this moving. So those are the three that really gives Pennsylvanians and doctors a lot of protection. That's what's really needed.
That reminds me, in Albany, New York, I was giving one of the talks that I gave a couple of years back, and the place was crowded. The square was crowded. We were outside of the Capitol buildings, and a horde of doctors came out of one of the buildings carrying signs. And Del Bigtree was there. Bobby Kennedy was there. You know, Mary Holland, a huge number of people were there. And we all thought that they were coming to counter protest us. And so a contingent of our crew ran across the field to go talk to them. And they were very confrontational. Our people were being a little confrontational. And they came back laughing because the doctor said, no, we're on your side. We want to be able to offer choices, medical choices to the people. We don't want insurance companies and we don't want medical boards to restrict our ability to actually offer what we think are reasonable options for medical care, and they really respected patient freedom of choice, informed consent.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case across the board, but we get stuck in the standard of care model that basically puts doctors in the position of, if you don't follow, you know, standard of care, then there could be a lawsuit. So there's this fear factor that kind of goes into it that's handed down from the hospital. And I think you're right. Most doctors, we're seeing them leave in droves, nurses, doctors, because they are tired of the current standard. And they know there is more out there. There's more that can be done. And yet they're put in this position where they're unable to communicate that to their patients. And so I think this is big for medical professionals. This is big for the population, but this is really what we need to protect the rights of everybody. Whether you want to get the vaccine or not, you have the right to still go get the vaccine. No one is stopping you from getting that. But that person who doesn't want the vaccine should also have that same right in saying, no, this isn't for me. And really, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah, absolutely. So we saw in COVID over the last 2 years, especially with the lockdown, governors across the United States prioritize which businesses were considered essential and which were not essential. And I know you feel the same way, but it seems to me anyone who's working and has a job has a right to do so under some of the principles of the U.S. Constitution. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness all encompasses. You have the right to actually try to make a living. You have a right to have a wage and an income if you are talented enough and skilled enough and lucky enough to find employment. You have the right to create a business and offer other people the same thing. And who is the government, a state government of all things, to prioritize businesses as being essential versus non-essential? And the governor of Pennsylvania took out his pen and struck off a huge number of small businesses. And so that, how is that going over there in Pennsylvania? Are the small businesses still struggling as a result of, you know, 3 months of lockdown?
Yeah, some of the ones that did comply did end up being shut down. None of them that have gone to court have, Governor Wolf and his team have not won. So they do not have the right to shut down these businesses. And it's been shown over and over again in court. So I think people need to be aware. Just say no. Just say no to these crazy mandates, because you're right. We have a right to work. We have a right to pursue happiness and freedom, you know, all the stuff that goes into the liberty that's been handed down to us. And so you just have to have a little bit of courage. There are some amazing freedom fighter lawyers out there who are helping people. Some are at a really amazing price. I mean, people are passionate about this. They recognize the importance of this. And we just need to stand together and say no together. And if we do that, they can't do anything.
Absolutely. So this is why it's so important to buy local, support your mom and pop shop. And
100%.
Make sure you eat local, you wear local, you drive local, everything that you can do. Don't use chains as much as, small business owners. They still need our support. That was an economic disaster that you were present when I gave my speech inside the Pennsylvania State Capitol, and that little speech of mine went viral, how I was talking about
yes,
shutting down,
I've seen you in 20 different languages.
Shutting down businesses this way and telling people they can't go to work just because they tested positive with a bogus PCR test is like setting off bombs. And so the economic, you know, bomb after bomb after bomb, and the economic well-being of our entire every state in the nation depends on people standing up for their intrinsic rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So I want to ask you, Stephanie, where can people go? You're part of Pennsylvania Coalition for Informed Consent. Where can people go to read about these bills, get ready to act on them, and where can they sign up for information?
So informedconsentpa.org. List all the bills that we're watching, all the bills that we're actively trying to support, and gives you information on how to sign up. There's quite a few amazing grassroots organizations across the state of Pennsylvania that are all working together on this. But PCIC or PA, Form Consent PA is a great place to start. so that you can just get educated and start telling other people what to do. Calling whoever your legislator is, your senator is, calling leadership and telling them what bills that you want to be brought to the floor. All of those are hugely important. They need to hear from you. Emails, they get a ton of emails. Make a phone call, stop into their office. You have to remember, we are paying their salaries. And so we have a right to go in there and have these conversations. And I've gone in and I've had very difficult conversations with some of these guys. And as long as you don't get really aggravated with them or something like that, they're generally pretty open, but they need to know that they have our support. Otherwise, they are depending upon what the mass media is telling them that we want. And what I'm finding is a lot of cases, that's not the case, right? That's not what people actually want. And so our personal voices have to be heard. So, make that phone call. It'll take you 5-10 minutes, but it is so worth it in the long run. Let people know where you stand on these positions so that they know they have someone who's going to back them up come election time when they have to go up for re-election.
That's great advice. It's also a good tactic to make sure that you bring along 2 or 3 other people with you towards making the phone calls, sending in your emails, and getting the message driven home. So Dr. Coxon, thank you so much for brightening our day here on America Out Loud Pulse. My name is Dr. James Lance Weiler, and we will be seeing you all next week.